Sketches at Irregular Hours, episode 135 for October 27th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
Good evening. I'm Chip Essenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we are here with the ending, the last part of our wonderful, wonderful examination of Dracula from 1897.
The children of the night are sending us tweets.
Their beautiful music coming through the Twitter.
Wow, I really wish I could do voices. You guys rock.
This is so much fun. I know how much I love the story of Dracula. And now going through this original novel as a pretty deep dive here, I really love this story, Pam.
I love this story too. And it's been such a pleasure over the years to teach it to many, many 18 to 24 year olds who think they know the story of Dracula but have never read the novel, and to find how often this becomes one of their favorite novels. And they don't expect that. An epistolary novel from the late 19th century. How is it this good? But it really, really is. And I think that just like any excellent novel, one of the reasons it's so great is because of the characters. And so I love asking people just a very simple question, not a deep literary critical question, but who's your favorite character in this novel and why? May I just ask you guys that?
Was it Harry Potter, or was it Hermione, or Ron?
There are other novels other than the Harry Potter, Chip. There are other novels in the world.
We spent a lot of time trying to find the Horcruxes here, and we got down to the final one. So I'm going to say it's going to be Mina for $1,000, please.
And why is that, my dear?
She seemed to have everybody organized. She seemed to be the one, if we were going to rewrite this and for a new publication or for a movie or something, I think we would throw her as our central character. Now, maybe 20 or 30 years ago, we would have Van Helsing as sort of the superhero of the day. But really, I mean, as I was reading this, I kept finding her as the one that she organized it. It just seemed like she was on the ball of what was going on, where everyone else was more into action. She was kind of putting it together and placing the clues.
It's very interesting that the beginning of the book, we certainly centered on Jonathan as the central character. And now, to be fair, this is the story of Dracula. Dracula is the main character of Dracula. But Jonathan Harker was the semi-protagonist at the beginning of the novel. And that changes very quickly when we switch to London and we get to meet this whole team of people. And yes, I agree that Mina becomes the central character other than Dracula that is there as our protagonist in this team. But it's that whole team that really comes together to be more than the sum of its parts. We needed all of those people for this story to go the way it did.
Somebody had to organize all those letters.
But isn't it interesting? Isn't it interesting that in this team, which is sometimes called the Crew of Light, we have four attractive, able-bodied younger men. We have Jonathan Harker, John Seward, Lord Godalming, and Quincy Morris. But really, the two characters we're talking about who truly make it happen are a 72-year-old Dutch doctor in Van Helsing and a 20-something young woman. And so it's kind of amazing in 1897 that those are the leaders. This elderly man and this young woman are really the people who make it all happen.
And I think that this comes down to one of the themes of this story, that idea of the mind, the idea of the power of thinking over this supernatural element. This is not necessarily religion, although religion is certainly a big theme that we see, especially in this fourth part here, but that idea of the thoughts of Van Helsing, the knowledge that he carries, added to the critical putting together information that Mina gives us, that's the solution to this problem.
Well, and it's interesting because Mina has these organizational skills that we've all just talked about that are vital to not only defeating Dracula, but to telling us the story, right? She's the one who's put together the documents that we are reading. And there's something just so metafictionally delightful about that.
Very much like our Watson in our Sherlock stories.
Good connection, Steve.
Ding, 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 ding. 3 points for Gryffindor there.
Having that character, that first-person character, metafictionally in the story while at the same time giving us that information that she is acquiring throughout this investigation. That's why we loved Sherlock. We said that so many times. And that's great writing.
And the other thing about Mina that we must not forget is that she is a young woman who is, you know, erotically attractive. And so she's, at first, she's so contrasted with Lucy, right? Lucy's the pretty one, Mina's the smart one. All these men want to marry Lucy, and Dracula attacks Lucy, and she becomes this sort of terrifying, voluptuous, seductive vampiress, okay? But Mina is not unattractive either. And it seems like the men in the Crew of Light sort of turn their love for Lucy into this deep affection, non-erotic, because Mina is taken. She's Jonathan's wife by this point. But they do really love Mina. And then furthermore, there's that amazing scene where Mina does become an object of desire to Dracula. And I think that scene is one of my favorites in the novel, where Dracula enters Jonathan and Mina's bedroom, right? And that's why they have to be married before that scene in the novel. They do share a bedroom.
Cue the love theme.
Thank you. Jonathan is passed out on the bed, and Dracula, when the men break down the door because they know something bad is happening in the bedroom, Mina and Dracula are standing together. Dracula's shirt is open, his chest has been cut, and he's holding Mina's head to his chest like a child would hold a kitten's face in a bowl of milk to make that kitten drink. It's such a horribly creepy sexual violation scene, but it means that Mina gets partway towards becoming a vampire herself, which becomes crucially important to stopping Dracula.
Yeah, it does. But at the
same
time,
that's how she knows where he is. Their mind melded.
Yes, again, back to that idea of the mind and thinking and intelligence is the major theme. But boy, I gotta tell you, Pam, this fourth section really drags. This is not the action climax of the story. You stopped me in the third part from saying the third part was the action climax. I can argue that, boy, the action took place in part three, and the mind connection and the boat, and we're gonna go get him. No, we're gonna go get him. No, seriously, we're gonna find him. It's like, okay, I get it.
But Steve, I think that, okay, so obviously the killing of Lucy, right, the actual, like, the staking of Lucy, turning her back into the beautiful soul of Lucy Westenra before she became a vampire, that is very climactic. But I do think that you can't say you've hit the climax until Mina has been attacked, because she is both a damsel in distress and a young new woman, a young feminist. And so she does not allow the attack from this master vampire to prevent her from fighting back. And so her, right? So, like, and that, the host, I mean, we have to talk about religion and religious symbols, but the fact that she has this sort of half host scar on her forehead that marks her connection to the vampire. I mean, the climax of the scene, I think, is when Quincy Morris looks at Mina and says, oh, your scar is healed. That's you know?
But that's not action. That's so... the action...
I hear you, though.
When you asked us who's your favorite character, I almost said Lucy, because Lucy's action, Lucy's narrative is so much more exciting than Mina's narrative.
Kylo and Rey were totally connected by the Force state.
That kiss at the end makes perfect sense. Just go with it.
Just, it's like the Force Ghost type thing, Steve. The Dracula and Mina are connected.
Ancient religions. Let's let's get to religion here. There's certainly in part four, boy, oh boy, is Bram Stoker here really hitting hard the idea of religion, specifically Catholicism here, right?
Yes. And it's interesting that Van Helsing, who's, you know, this Catholic from Amsterdam, he's been given a consecrated host. Now, people, this is not a very, I don't know which branch of Catholicism he's a part of, but they don't usually hand out the consecrated host for vampire fighting.
Did you catch how he got it?
Maybe not.
He paid for it with an indulgence.
Right.
He offered money for this weapon of religious significance. The idea here that Catholic belief of transubstantiation is on display here. As Catholics, we believe that that bread and that wine are really, not symbolically, truly turned into the body and blood of Christ. And the idea here that this religious symbol is powerful is something Bram Stoker's trying to say. And in with that is this idea of blood being powerful.
And this notion of the host as weapon. Whew. This is a very tricky business, right? That you would actually be able to use the body of Christ in a fight against evil, against this ancient evil attempt at immortality.
Basically, a defiance of the human condition. This life is not meant to be eternal.
And in defiance, therefore, of the religion and of God is interesting. This existence that is outside of that norm is evil. We don't get holy water. There's no holy water in this as a weapon.
We get plenty of crucifixes.
Mm-hmm.
Even from the very beginning, when Jonathan Harker is given a crucifix on his journey to Dracula's castle. And, you know, we also get the need for faith. And that's why, you know, this is such a 19th century text. It comes right straight out of the Gothic. We've got moldering castles. We've got damsels in distress. We've got rain and fog and all of those atmospheric horror conditions. But we also have what is really central to the Gothic for literary critics. We have clashing epistemologies. Different ways of knowing that are really, really central to Victorians and how they're seeing the world. We have John Seward, who is pretty much strictly a science believer, right? He's like, everything can be explained through psychology, this new science that goes into the human mind. And then we have Van Helsing, who is a doctor and a lawyer and the carrier of a consecrated host, who 100% believes that if you have enough faith in God, you can defeat the vampire, which you're not going to be able to do with just science or just law, but you're going to need to combine the three kind of approaches.
And adding hypnosis to that, so that study of the mind.
Yeah, that's in the science realm for this novel, though. Don't you think that hypnosis was presented as if, like, this is a great new science technique, right up there with blood transfusions?
That theme of the mind is there again. The Jonathan Seward character that is studying the human mind and the study of the power of thinking. That's a huge theme. And Van Helsing, this expert in vampires, is using hypnosis, which is very much in that same science realm where we are studying how humans work. But you're right, that faith part, that absolute faith that Van Helsing is sure that he must be religious and believe in God in order for this to happen. The word God appears 265 times in this novel when you include the name Godalming. That's a lot of God in here. And boy, this fourth section is the most God-filled piece. I mean, they are always saying in God's hands, and it will be God's will, and God alone knows. Boy, oh boy, we get it.
Certainly that is on the mind of, I guess, the modern human during this period of time, the Victorian person, this idea of, you know, we just had Darwin's book being released. We're changing on how we're looking at things. It's challenging or changing how we view religion. Certainly those are very hot topics of that time.
You know, and it's interesting because I love that you did a word count, Steve. I wouldn't have thought to do that, but there's also the notion that Dracula, who is a centuries-old vampire and who's seen as strictly evil, we have to kill this guy. When Dracula is dying, you get this description, quote, "Even in that moment of final dissolution, there was in the face a look of peace, such as I never could have imagined might have rested there." So when they do kill Dracula, they release his soul, just like they did with Lucy's. So the matter of faith is not just about saving the nice young British Victorian women like Lucy and Mina. It's also a matter of reclaiming for God this centuries-old vampire from Transylvania who represents all kind of terrifying threats to Victorian England.
That's a very interesting way of describing that, because you're right. All of a sudden, he can experience death, which basically reintroduces the human experience.
Mm-hmm. And that's where the action ends. And I know that, Pam, you love endings, so I'm going to count this as a pseudo-ending. The end of the action comes here. It says, "The sun was now right down upon the mountaintop, and the red gleams fell upon my face, so that it was bathed in rosy light. With one impulse, the men sank on their knees, and a deep and earnest amen broke from all as their eyes followed the pointing of his finger. The dying man spoke, 'Now God be thanked that all has not been in vain. See, the snow is not more stainless than her forehead. The curse has passed away.'" This is Quincy Morris dying. His dying words is, "Mina's okay," and they are all in prayer with the word amen.
And that, in a lot of ways, is the climax of this story, I think, between Dracula's death and then Mina's salvation.
It's
just
such
a moment
weak
later.
Climax. Even the destruction of Dracula was like, yeah, and then I cut his throat and he stabbed him. The end.
And then his soul was released and Mina was saved. Okay, but you guys.
And then we have snow that covers up everything. Makes it beautiful.
Yeah.
Okay, you guys, can we talk about Quincy Morris the American? I thought so much about our conversations about Doyle's descriptions of Americans. There was this moment.
We certainly can, by thunder.
Thank you, Jeff. There was this moment that made me laugh so hard. When they were traveling, and this is from Mina's diary, she says, "Mr. Morris took me to the hotel where our rooms had been ordered by telegraph, he being the one who could best be spared, since he does not speak any foreign language." And it's like, you know the joke where, like, you know, a trilingual speaks three languages, a bilingual speaks two languages, a monolingual is an American. You know that joke, right?
Yes.
And so it's horrible. But this notion of, you know, a UK writer representing, like, the American, he's such a
good, brave, brawny, strong Texas cowboy. And he gives his life to save Mina and to kill Dracula. But at the same time, you make just a little bit of fun with him. Right? It's just such an... I had not noticed... I will tell you guys, I've read this novel many times. I had not noticed that line about Quincy Morris. And it's you guys and reading the Sherlock Holmes with you and really paying attention to how Americans are represented that made me pause on that.
Nedley, who was the guy? Nedley.
Yes, and From Hell.
When the doctor is driving him around and talking about him, and he's like, oh, thank you. So, yeah, we're the American. Oh, thank you.
The idea of all of the guns that are brought into the situation, all of the Winchesters specifically, and all of this very American, how we're going to solve this problem, is very much on display here, yes.
The Team America approach, Steve.
Yes. Shoot first, ask questions never. Yes.
And they didn't thank us.
One of the big themes I keep coming back to is this idea of human thinking. Mina is the logical thinker of the team. She finds herself mentally linked to Dracula here. And that is, where we get the solution is through the mind, the study of the mind that's been on display throughout the whole novel.
And you guys, that's a place where this is a moment of first wave feminism, right? Women's minds are just as strong as men's. Some would argue stronger, whereas women's bodies are, on average, weaker than men's bodies. And so the way that Stoker dramatizes this conflict is very feminist. Every time I read this, I think, ooh, did I oversell in my mind how feminist this 1897 novel written by a man is? No, this novel is super feminist. It's Mina's mind that allows for the resolution of a conflict, the saving of Victorian England.
It would be interesting to look who was purchasing this book at the time. And my question is, do we find a large group of women purchasing, and was that one of the target audiences of it? Because, we all read and things of that nature, but, was this pop art at the time, and there is a large group of women readers, and that would be maybe one of the reasons to cater to that audience.
That's a great question, Chip. I wish I had the answer to that. Pam, that sounds like a thesis that you should write and publish.
There we go.
It might well have been done. There's so much scholarship on this book, as you might imagine. I'm not fully up on it. Sorry.
It's a great question, though, because I think it definitely drives the story. The mind of this particular woman, not so much Lucy, but Mina's mind is the solution here, including her obsession with train schedules. Did you catch this? They get to this foreign land, and she's under the influence of a vampire, for God's sakes. And they go, boy, we got to catch a train. When do you think the train comes? And she pops out of her vampire state and goes, this train comes at 1:14.
She is in Scooby-Doo world. She is the Velma of everyone.
Very much. She is very much the Velma of this mystery. Interesting. Now I like this book even more.
Now, but don't forget that she's constantly trying to not sell herself as a feminist. So that passage where she says, this is the way. Van Helsing says, how know you it? I ask, of course I know it, she answered. And with a pause add, have not my Jonathan traveled it and wrote of his travel? At first I think somewhat strange, but soon I see that there be only one such by-road. It is used but little and very different from the coach road from the Bukovina to Bistris, which is more wide and hard and more of use. And so you have this idea that Van Helsing's like, Mina, how do you know where we're, not only the train schedule, but which road to take? And she's like, this is Jonathan. I know I always support my husband. I've learned all of these things in order to support my lawyer husband.
But she says there's only one road.
Right.
But on the grand scheme of things, that was ultimately what the modern woman would be at that time. That the person who is on top of all this stuff, you know, obviously her husband's position is a little different, but she's got him all set up.
She's the behind the scenes person in charge. She is doing the work to help her husband. And she might think, she might believe that she's not powerful and feminist, but she is certainly the one behind the work.
It's show don't tell time, right? So we see her power, even though she will never admit to it.
Mm-hmm. And if you think about, if you were the modern woman of that time, you may look at, I mean, I'm talking about reading it during the period that this came out. You may look at Lucy and say, okay, that's, you know, that's a friend of mine, but I want to be like Mina. And this is how I'm going to express myself in this age.
Right.
We're looking at it, you know, what, 130 years later, 150 years later. And certainly we're layering up another part on top of it. But certainly I would say this is, you know, written of its time and certainly modern of its time, too, of what the ideal would be.
Are you saying that it's a good idea to read a late Victorian novel, Chip?
What a great time, a little COVID time to revisit the past.
It's a great time to stop reading late Victorian novels, my friend.
We've got still a couple more things to say about all this right. one before we move forward. Okay, but guys.
Blah, blah, blah.
I also want to note that Mina's brain is characterized really, really interestingly. So Van Helsing says that... okay, her brain, which is trained like man's brain, but is of sweet woman and have a special power which the Count give her, and which he may not take away altogether, though he think not so. Hush, let me speak, and you shall learn. Oh, John, my friend, we are in awful straits. I fear as I never feared before. We can only trust the good God. So this is a really, I think, interesting passage where Van Helsing, whose accent I did not attempt there, forgive me, but he thinks about how Mina's brain, and he says this in a few different places, is as powerful as a man's brain, but is sort of tempered by a woman's attitudes or a woman's sweetness. And that is what allows her to be connected to Dracula without Dracula realizing it. And so there's a certain duality to her intelligence that is really being celebrated in this novel.
And we keep getting this metaphor of Dracula as a child brain because he is in this tomb for so long, but not maturing mentally in that situation. And that comparison between this child brain versus Mina's very strong dualistic brain is very interesting.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to defend Dracula, but he's stuck in Transylvania for potentially centuries. So the modern world is escalating so much around him, and he is isolated from that. So just like if you threw somebody from the 1700s to today or the 1800s to today, they may be overwhelmed with what's available. All you have to do is take them to a grocery store and like, oh my goodness.
And think about all of that technology that we've talked about in The Devil in the White City, that 1893 World's Fair here in Chicago, where so much innovation happened. It is still a pivotal moment in all of that technology, all of that change in thinking. That's where Bram Stoker's mind is with this, thinking about how much has happened in such a short amount of time.
Sure.
Well, and it's interesting because, like, one of the questions, of course, that we've sort of talked about all the way through these 4 weeks on this novel is the question of what does the vampire represent? And in a sense, you know, the vampire represents threats, many, many, many threats. The threat of the immigrant arriving, coming to London with all his, you know, foreign ways that we don't fully understand, superstitions, you know, his designs on our women, et cetera, et cetera. But then there's also, there's the threat of losing religion, right? So if the modern world is all about science, if we understand the mind through psychology rather than theology, where does that leave religion? And the vampire, in a way, is not only a threat, but a salvation that requires us to combine scientific and religious thinking. That's the only way you can beat the vampire. You can't beat the vampire by arming a bunch of people with Winchester rifles. You have to understand how the vampire functions. You have to know to cut off the head, to stake the body. You have to have the faith to see the vampire's soul when you have killed this evil. And so it's a really amazingly powerful symbol or metaphor for the period.
Obviously, he chose to go to England. He didn't want to go to Italy. Too much garlic.
Too much garlic. I love that podcast. Too much garlic. Yeah, I didn't do well in Italy. Boy, I just asked for lettuce, and they were like, you want some lettuce? And I'm like, yes, can I have some lettuce? And they're like, do you want some dressing on that? I'm like, no, all of your dressing has garlic in it. Can I just get some lettuce for my, you know, for my system? And they just looked at me and shook their heads and gave me, like, rabbit food.
So Steve ordered lettuce and toilet water, you know, his water still, without bubbles.
That was my trip to Italy.
So Steve's got a little vampire in him, perhaps.
More than a little, my friend.
Got it.
this is my lifestyle. Sour cream, no garlic, and a lot of paprika.
Yeah, that's right. All different types of paprika. Who knew there were so many types of paprika?
So we get to the ending of this tale, Pam. Your favorite part of every story that we've talked about for 135 episodes, the ending.
All right. So we had the ending, the climactic, or perhaps climactic ending of Dracula's death and Mina's salvation. And now we get this final little note written to us by Jonathan Harker 7 years after the fact. And here he tells us what's happened to everybody. So Van Helsing, who was 72 years old, we don't hear too much about, we presume he's fine. Jonathan Seward and Lord Godalming, they're both happily married. And you guys, Mina and John had a baby, and they named him Quincy. After, of course, that brave American with his big Texas hat and all of his rifles. And so at the end, Jonathan concludes by saying, "We want no proofs. We ask none to believe us. This boy, young Quincy Harker, will someday know what a brave and gallant woman his mother is. Already he knows her sweetness and loving care. Later on, he will understand how some men so loved her that they did dare much for her sake. Sincerely, Jonathan Harker." Now, this is a really interesting ending that ends on a celebration of Mina as not only a young feminist woman, but also a mother who the child at 7 years old or 6 years old, he now thinks of her as this sweet person, but eventually he's going to grow up and realize that his mother is a formidable woman, right? He's going to be a feminist.
Well, he didn't realize his mother was Wonder Woman.
Right, exactly. And so what do you guys think about ending with Jonathan Harker?
Well, it's good writing, because the beginning of the story was Jonathan Harker. The beginning, he was as such the protagonist at the beginning. So it's logical for writing for him to be the last word of this story. But as the story progressed, it might have worked better for Mina to have that final word, to be the one who has the power at the end, because Jonathan wasn't that powerful a character, as it turns out.
Well, I'm looking at this as going back to my question, who is the person reading this story? We have this superstar woman who not only had this crazy adventure and is super organized and knows everything and keeps her husband organized, and now is a mother, and everything, you know, the birth date of the child was like the perfect day to have the child born, you know, honoring the past. And It just seems like maybe the audience of this was women.
But those women still being in 1897, still feeling like their husbands should take the spotlight. So Jonathan has that final word. I could see that.
And Mina is never going to tell us, I'm amazing, right? She is downplayed. She's a very good, modest Victorian woman. She has downplayed her own contributions all the way through. So you do need Jonathan, who did open this narrative and who slept through Dracula's assault on his wife to come in at the end and say, I needed my wife to save me and the country.
Hmm. Nice.
And we shall document this in a book.
There you go. So what do you think, Chip? Is this a book that you would suggest other people read now that we've done our deep dive on Dracula?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you think of the great books that a person should read in their lifetime, Dracula would definitely be on that list. These are the pop books that made culture what it is today, at least Western culture.
There's certainly a lot of pop culture to this one. We know this character. And even those of you who have never read this book, you know Dracula. But now we know even more about all of the other characters in this story. I do suggest that people go and watch the Bram Stoker's Dracula movie from 1992, the Francis Ford Coppola. They played with the story a little bit. There was a little play there. But it's pretty good as a movie storytelling.
Whoa.
And it's much closer to the original than I think any other movie. Like, he really went back to Stoker's novel instead of working from that 1931 movie that so many other versions have done.
But there's elements of that 1931 in uh-huh. that 1992 You're right. as well. He You're plays right. with that pop culture entity that is Dracula, and then he adds a little extra little storyline to tie some things together that Bram Stoker didn't have, like as to motivation. Why would Dracula want to do this? That's in the movie, not really in the book.
Right.
Why would we wear crazy bun hair? I don't know.
Because we're Princess Leia. I don't know where you were going with that. The Gary Oldman silly hairdo. Yeah. Yeah.
The crazy hairdo he has.
Yeah. Just to make him look crazy. Just to make him look very, very, very unusual. Like, what is going on with this human?
Yeah.
Well, and also to play up his, like, foreign attributes, right? This True. Is not a typical London hairstyle.
True. Excellent. So, we're done with this book.
All Steve, right. Thanks for reading with me, you guys. It was such a pleasure to share this with you guys.
It was a lot of fun. But you know what I really think we should do? Go back in time.
So now that we have read Steve's pick, Chip's pick, and now my pick, Steve, it's your turn to bring us back. What do we read next week, my friend?
Another Victorian novel. No! I'm kidding! We're going to get out of the Victorian era for once and get into a more modern storytelling. We're going to read one of my favorite novels of all time. And when I say one of, there might be two books on this list.
Wow.
This might be one of my two favorite books of all time. We are going to read Audrey Neffenegger's The Time Traveler's Wife from 2003 starting next week. Let me just go with, I'm excited to share this story with the two of you. I'm excited to hear Pam's very professorial viewpoint on all of this story. And Chip, I've been asking you to read this story for 6 years, so I'm really excited to hear your view on this as well.
So what chapters are we reading?
Here's the thing, Chip. Audrey wrote three different portions of this book, and she called them book one, book two, and book three. But book two is twice as long, so we're going to take 2 weeks to get through book two. That's the real meat of the story. So today's assignment for next week, you are going to read book one of The Time Traveler's Wife.
Excellent.
And so, Chip, is this going to be your first time reading it?
It is.
Wonderful. Now, I read it when it first came out. I loved it, but I'm definitely ready for a reread. So I am super excited about this as well.
Chip, you've seen this movie, right?
Well, I've seen the movie, and I can't remember a lot about the movie, but let's just say that I have the skeleton to hold the meat on.
And we've talked about this. This is something that I ask people all the time. Do you watch the movie first or do you read the book first? I definitely read the book first on this, probably twice before the movie came out. I think I've read this book cover to cover 5 times since 2003. I love this book. I love the idea of time travel, which is a big part of my day. And I love how Audrey put together this story, jumping back and forth through time in such a touching narrative. I hope everybody enjoys it along with us next week.
I remember crying a lot during this story.
I started reading chapter 1 again this week before this recording, and yes, the moment in chapter 1, I don't know how she did it, but in chapter 1, in the introduction of these characters, there is the most touching moment that, yes, brings me to tears every time. It's amazing.
I'm going to have a heart when I read this?
Hope so, Chip. I hope that you see the longing of this character. The idea of the time traveler's wife is that she is stuck. She is lost. While he is lost in time, she has no way to know when he'll be back. And that feeling, that emotion is throughout this story in such a beautiful way. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week.
What do you think, Pam? We ready for a non-Victorian novel?
Not only are we ready for a non-Victorian novel, I'm wondering if we are ready for NaNoWriMo.
Oh, you're going to get us into NaNoWriMo, aren't you, Professor?
National Novel Writing Month. NaNoWriMo just flows off the tongue, right?
So what's our assignment, Professor?
Okay, I really can't assign people to write 50,000 words in 30 days. However, I just want to let you guys know that I'm going to really try to do NaNoWriMo this month. So every November, approximately 300,000 people around the world sign up for this super crazy assignment to write 50,000 words, which is the length of a short novel. The Great Gatsby is the good example of something that comes in at pretty much exactly 50,000. And the idea of NaNoWriMo is that you go on the website for NaNoWriMo, you don't share anything that you've written, you just share your word count. And you try to do it with friends if you can, and you basically commit yourself for these 30 days. I'm going to do no revising. I'm just going to write. I'm going to write down scenes, dialogue, notes, whatever. I'm going to write down towards my novel. I'll edit later. It's about writing every day, getting in the habit, and also the community of writing. So as we're just concluding the community of vampire fighting, community is good in lots of areas of our lives, my friends. So Not to give you guys the hard sell, but I think you guys both have novels inside of you. I hope I do too. I think we should do NaNoWriMo, and I think our listeners should too.
Wow. You know, I wrote a short story this year.
You did, and it was very funny.
And so maybe there's something I could write. And Steve wrote something too.
I did. And yes, Pam, we can commit to trying to write a novel in the month of November. NaNoWriMo, go to NaNoWriMo.org or go to our show notes and write along with us. Let's make a community of it. Let's publish our successes, how many words we have actually been able to put down on paper, and let's make it happen. Fine.
And just remember, nothing bad happens if you don't hit 50,000. It's really about committing to yourself. And I think, I don't want to tell other people how they feel, but man, it is. We're heading into month 8 of the pandemic. And I think that for everyone's mental health, even though it feels like a huge commitment, it's also something really generative, transformative, transporting that I think a lot of us, certainly myself, can really benefit from doing.
Well, we sat down and we read every one of the Sherlock Holmes stories. And yeah. At the beginning, we were like, oh, we'll never be able to get through all of them. And we certainly did. And now we've moved beyond to other novels. But that discipline of reading a story a day and then discussing it, this is similar but different. We're yep. now, you're not, I shouldn't say passively, when you read, you're actively reading. But this is, requires you to kind of make something up along the way yep. and kind of push forward and test yourself. And like I said, it could totally fail, but it doesn't matter. The matter is the activity and what it can do for you.
Fine. We'll write. I got
awesome.
It, Professor.
You guys rock. Thank you.
We would love to hear from you. We would love to have you write along with us for the month of November, the best month of the whole year, by the way. If you need more information, give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4867. Our website is sandwichesatirregularhours.com. Our email is sandwiches@irregularhours@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and YouTube and on NaNoWriMo.org, where we'll be writing for November. I want to thank you again for listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I am Chip Hessenfeld.
And I'm Half the Dog.
See you in the future.